KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump wants to shut down the Department of Education. We speak with Tennessee's former education commissioner about how this could play out in classrooms across the country. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. An NPR investigation helped thousands of veterans stay in their homes after a VA mistake. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez, but now some Republicans want to shut down the fix, saying it's too risky for taxpayers. Also, new evidence that living through normal flu seasons could give us some protection against bird flu, and why a fire in London is disrupting air travel around the world. It's Friday, March 21st. Happy birthday to the wizard himself. Soccer star Ronaldinho turns 45. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal Judge James Boasberg is criticizing the Trump administration. He says it gave a, quote, woefully insufficient response to his orders in a case involving the Alien Enemies Act. NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports he is seeking more information about the deportation flights of hundreds of Venezuelan migrants last weekend.
Boasberg had issued an emergency order to temporarily block President Trump's use of the wartime authority known as the Alien Enemies Act to quickly deport people. But some planes carrying hundreds of people still flew to El Salvador. Boasberg is seeking details about the government's compliance with his order. In a filing, a regional immigration and customs official said that cabinet secretaries are considering whether to refuse to provide evidence in the court case on grounds that it's information that could harm national security or foreign relations. Boasberg ordered the government to explain any discussions regarding this matter, known as invoking the privilege of state secrets, and to decide whether to invoke such privilege by March 25th. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
Federal safety officials say that for years, the state of Maryland failed to check the Francis Scott Key Bridge near Baltimore. Parts of it collapsed last year after an enormous cargo ship collided with the bridge, killing six people. The National Transportation Safety Board says as bridges have gotten older, ships have gotten a lot bigger, and government authorities have failed to take extra precautions. From member station WYPR, Scott Massioni reports the NTSB says the Baltimore area bridge isn't the only one that needed to be reviewed.
It also identified 68 other bridges across the country that weren't built to the needs and specifications. NTSB is strongly urging those bridge owners right now to conduct assessments, to report back to the NTSB with remediation plans. And those bridges, they span from California to Washington to New York. They're all over the United States.
Scott Massioni reporting. European Union leaders have agreed at a summit to keep up the pressure on Russia to end its war on Ukraine. Terry Schultz reports on some disagreements.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas failed to get enough support for her proposed 40 billion euro assistance package for Ukraine, so she's adapted that to trying to provide 2 million artillery shells worth 5 billion euros. Kallas spoke at the EU's latest summit focused on defense investment.
Let's decide on the short term, which is the imminent needs that Ukraine has regarding the ammunition right now.
Leaders debated European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's readiness plan, which includes EU loans to countries buying weapons from European manufacturers.
It is of utmost importance that we develop the defense industrial base in the European Union.
That's part of the bloc's urgent efforts to reduce security dependence on the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Israel's Supreme Court has temporarily blocked the firing of Israel's top domestic intelligence chief. Israel's prime minister had moved to fire the leader of the agency, Shin Bet. The Israeli Supreme Court says this is on hold until April 8th to allow time for a hearing. International airline flights around the world have been snarled. That's because power is out at a major hub, London's Heathrow Airport. Officials say a fire at a nearby substation cut the power. The airport is closed for the day. London police say there is no indication of foul play, but counterterrorism officials are leading the British investigation into the fire. People don't remember anything from the time that they were babies, but is that because people don't make memories when they're infants? Reporter Ari Daniel says new research may hold the answer.
One of the hardest parts of this study was getting the babies into the fMRI machine.
Infants, in many ways, are the worst possible, you know, subject population.
That's Yale cognitive neuroscientist Nick Turk-Brown. His team showed infants a series of images they'd never seen before while snapping photos of their brains, including the hippocampus.
A region that we know is super important for memory in adults.
Tristan Yates is a cognitive neuroscientist at Columbia. The more active the hippocampus was when seeing an image for the first time, the more likely babies were to remember it later, meaning that infants seem to form memories. Whether we can retrieve them later in life remains an open question. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadili in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, we'll hear how Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is using U.S. deportations to boost his image at home. But first, President Trump is using his executive power to try and shut down the U.S. Department of Education. NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta has been following the story and joins us now. Hey, Janaki.
Hey, Layla.
So, Janaki, let's start with the executive action President Trump signed yesterday that aims to eliminate the Education Department. And we expected this, but can the president just eliminate the Department of Education?
No, that actually requires an act of Congress. The action essentially tells the Secretary of Education to take all steps towards eliminating the department to the maximum extent possible under the law. And we've already seen the Trump administration move towards that goal by cutting the department workforce nearly in half. Many of the Ed Department's employees are going to have their last day today before being put on administrative leave.
So even without an act of Congress, the steps begin now. And your reporting has found that nearly the entire staff of the Education Department's data agency is being laid off. What exactly does that agency do?
Yeah, so the National Center for Education Statistics, or NCES, has been the central source of data about education in the U.S. for more than 150 years. At the start of this year, more than 100 people were working there, and after today, just three NCES staff will remain. That's according to multiple employees at NCES and an internal email we've reviewed. And nearly all the data experts responsible for determining whether schools qualify for certain federal grants will soon be out of jobs.
So this data agency being eliminated, what does it mean for schools?
So part of what NCES works on are known as formula grants for schools, things like Title I, which goes to low-income schools, and also funding for rural schools through the Rural Education Achievement Program. Those are just two examples, but if there aren't data people crunching these numbers, employees tell us it's going to be really hard for schools to get that money. I talked to Amy Price Azano, who leads the Center for Rural Education at Virginia Tech, and she said, it's important to remember the students on the other side of this money.
When we talk about percents and all of this, we forget that that's a real kid And so how will those kids have everything that they need to be successful in school, to be safe in school?
And I should say, we did reach out to the Ed Department for comment on all of this, and they did not reply.
What kind of things do schools use that money for?
Yeah, so formula grants are actually really flexible. Once states and districts get these grants from the Ed Department, they primarily get to choose what to do with it. Like Title I or rural school grants could be used to pay school staff salaries, transportation costs, technology, really the nuts and bolts of what makes a school a school.
So how soon will schools feel the pain of this data being gone?
Yeah, I've spoken to employees at NCS who have worked on both grants for rural schools and on Title I, and they all tell me they're pretty confident districts will get the money they expect for the next school year, but they're really worried about what's going to happen after that. Like, if business was as usual, NCES staff would be hard at work right now gathering the data for the 2026-27 school year, and that is going to be a lot harder with just three employees. And I should add, Leila, NCS doesn't work alone when it comes to Title I. It works closely with the U.S. Census Bureau, but we learned earlier this week that the Trump administration is starting to shrink that agency too, and that could certainly further complicate the distribution of Title I funding.
NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta. Thank you, Janaki.
Thank you.
When President Trump signed the executive order to close the Federal Department of Education, Tennessee's Bill Lee was among the Republican governors circled around him in the Oval Office.
We want to return our students to the states where just some of the governors here are so happy about this. They want education to come back to them, to come back to the states, and they're going to do a phenomenal job.
Kevin Huffman is a former Tennessee Commissioner of Education who served under a former Republican governor, Bill Haslam. He currently leads Accelerate, an education nonprofit that advocates for more tutors in public schools. So, Kevin, let's start with what we just heard from President Trump. You worked on education at the state level. Does eliminating the Department of Education give the states more control over their education policies?
Not much. I mean, I think the whole thing is based on a false premise that somehow federal bureaucracy is the barrier and the reason why kids aren't learning more. But in my experience, that's not true. States already have lots of autonomy, and some use it well and some do not.
Yeah, and more control in recent years has headed states' way, right?
Correct. Yeah. States have been able to allocate money in with a fair amount of autonomy. They certainly have lots of freedom in defining what their goals are, what their strategies are. And the federal bureaucracy is not the reason why kids are not learning more.
So, Kevin, if states already have a firm grip on their own education policy, then what does eliminating this agency actually do?
I don't think it does very much. First of all, I'm not even sure it accomplishes the goal of reducing bureaucracy. If you are sitting in a state agency right now, you have to follow rules from the Department of Education, but they're talking about maintaining all of the same federal streams, but moving them to different departments. And so now you're imagining you've got to follow the rules from the Department of Labor, from Health and Human Services, from the Department of Justice. So it's not even clear to me that this serves the purpose, the narrow purpose of reducing bureaucracy.
Then does it maybe showcase a lack of a national plan?
It does. And that to me is the biggest red flag about all of this. President Trump called attention to the fact that reading and math scores are down. And I think this is a very important thing that we should be calling attention to. We peaked about a decade ago in reading and math scores in this country. And we need a national plan on how we are going to address this. I feel like American competitiveness is in the balance. But the idea that our solution is going to be eliminating any national direction and national guidance and national plan feels like a bit of a surrender to me.
Now, the president said a lot of things that the Department of Education does will move to other agencies, things like higher education funding, Pell Grants, resources for kids with disabilities. Kevin, practically speaking, what does that mean for states?
Yeah, like I said before, I think it means that you wind up dealing with lots of different agencies. And so, you know, it probably creates more confusion on the ground from states that are used to having a single source that they're dealing with. They still have to follow all of the rules to ensure that the funding gets to the right kids and to the right schools. I think one thing people misunderstand about federal funding, it is not intended to just backfill state spending. It is intended to be directed at specific kids with specific needs. So you've got special education funding that goes to kids who have dyslexia or learning disabilities. You have Title I money that's going to schools that serve low-income families disproportionately. And we need rules in place that ensure that the money actually gets to those specific kids.
In October, Kevin, you wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post where you stated that neither Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, the presidential candidates at the time, that they, quote, not bother to lay out a legitimate plan to bolster student results. So what kind of leadership would you want to see from the federal government in terms of education?
Yeah, I think you would want the Department of Education to say, these are our goals. We are attempting to increase reading scores by this amount. We are attempting to increase math scores by this amount. We are attempting to ensure that kids graduate from high school with these particular skills. You would want them to identify the states that are actually making enormous progress on this, have them showcase the great work that they're doing, call to task the places that are not making progress, and try to be a source for all of the information that only the federal government is really capable of gathering.
And quickly, Kevin, all those things you mentioned, without a Department of Education, is that possible to do, yes or no?
No. I think you just wind up relying on outside groups and outside entities. And you know, one of the most important things that the Department of Education does is gather data and become a source of truth. So when you wind up cutting all of the staff from NCES, you wind up with real challenges in identifying the places that are making enormous progress. And by the way, Tennessee is one of those places. So you would want to showcase the work that has actually led to results in different states.
Kevin Huffman, former education commissioner in the state of Tennessee. Kevin, thanks.
Thank you.
London's Heathrow Airport will stay closed all day after a fire in London caused a power outage. Heathrow is Europe's busiest airport, so the closure will affect more than 1,000 flights today. And as Villa Marx reports, the disruption will stretch into the weekend.
Several dozen firefighters have battled the substation blaze in the nearby town of Hayes, with more than 16,000 homes without power and more than 100 people evacuated. But the global impact of Heathrow's shutdown will affect hundreds of thousands more people, with dozens of international airlines forced to reconfigure their schedules to avoid Heathrow, which serves as the global hub for British Airways and several of its partners. London's Metropolitan Police have said there's no indication of foul play so far, but its counter-terrorism command is now involved in the investigation. Passenger Will Hastings in New York told the BBC that he and others had been waiting 4 hours for their bags to be offloaded from their cancelled flight, and he'll return home via Germany, but not for another 2 days.
I've been rebooked to go to Munich on Saturday, so they've pushed me right 2 days. I won't get back to the UK until Sunday afternoon now. Other people are going via various wonderful places, and it's crazy. Such a piece of critical national infrastructure has been impacted by one fire.
More than 100 other flights were forced to divert or even turn around while in mid-air, including one from Delhi that was carrying British passenger Lucy Adler, who also spoke to the BBC this morning.
Captain woke us all up and kind of said, hey, there's been a fire at Heathrow. And we all thought he was going to say, land at a different airport. It was a bit of a shock to the system to hear we were, like, flying a whole 9 hours to end up back where we started.
A spokesperson for Heathrow has warned of, quote, significant disruption in the days ahead and told passengers to avoid travelling to the airport, quote, under any circumstances. Britain's Energy Minister Ed Miliband said this morning the outage makes Heathrow look vulnerable and that lessons must be learned about how this was possible. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
This is NPR News.
I'm just a sweet transvestite.
50 years ago, a kinky spoof of horror films opened on Broadway and quickly bombed. But it also was adapted into a film, which became a cult classic. On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Rocky Horror Picture Show with the film's star, Tim Curry. And we remember the best-selling sports writer, John Feinstein. Join us.
Want something visual that's not too abysmal.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. A federal judge says government lawyers gave a, quote, woefully insufficient response to his demands for more details after the Trump administration deported hundreds of Venezuelans to a maximum security prison in El Salvador, despite the judge's order to turn the planes around. While the case plays out in court, officials in Venezuela and the U.S. continue to trade insults and threats. The Trump administration says the detainees were members of a violent gang. Venezuela says the U.S. and El Salvador, quote, kidnapped its citizens. Here's NPR's Carrie Kahn.
Venezuela's interior minister greeted a plane load of deportees from Mexico and Caracas Thursday. Many of the more than 300 aboard were women and children. They waved tiny Venezuelan flags and sang the national anthem, all on live TV. Unlike the direct deportation flights from the U.S., which Nicolas Maduro has stopped accepting, ones from Mexico continue. But the return flights don't usually get such broadcast welcomes by the government of Maduro, like this one yesterday. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said unless Maduro starts accepting U.S. flights, new sanctions will be slapped on Venezuela. U.S. officials yesterday also accused Maduro of lying about Thursday's repatriation from Mexico. His interior minister, Diosdado Cabello, returned the accusations. Someone is lying in the U.S., he said. Maduro says the hundreds of Venezuelans that he says were kidnapped and taken to El Salvador must be immediately returned. Jeff Ramsey of the Washington, D.C.-based Atlantic Council says Maduro is portraying himself now as a benevolent leader.
It's really astounding the degree to which the regime is capitalizing on the moment, and there doesn't really seem to be much of a clear plan to counteract that from Washington.
Nearly 8 million citizens have fled Venezuela in recent years due to the economic crisis and Maduro's tightening political control. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
The music of the band Japanese Breakfast is fraught with longing. In some of their early work, singer and songwriter Michelle Zauner longed for her mother, who died of cancer over a decade ago. Longing continues on their latest album as Zauner sorts through her complicated relationship with her father. Here's NPR's Lindsay Tati.
The songs on the latest Japanese Breakfast album tell stories of figures who yearn, some who don't get what they want, and others who do and wish they hadn't. Here's Michelle Zauner.
All of these characters succumb to some sort of temptation or disrupt a balance in their lives and are then grappling with the consequences or regrets of that decision-making.
Some of those regrets are inspired by people in Zauner's own life, like in this song, Little Girl.
Dreaming of a daughter who won't speak to me.
It is from the point of view of a father who regrets the decisions he's made that's led to an estrangement with his daughter. And I think that for personal reasons, there was some interest in that perspective.
Less than a year after her mother's death, Michelle Zahner lost her father too. He moved away to Thailand and began dating much younger women.
When people grieve or go through a great loss, there are just ugly parts that come out of people when they're in survival mode.
Eventually, Zahner and her father stopped speaking. In the years after her mother's death, Zahner dealt with her grief by writing music and a best-selling memoir. It's called Crying in H Mart. It chronicles her efforts to hold on to her Korean heritage while she was losing her Korean-born mother. After it was published, the New York Times reached her father for comment. He was dismayed about how his daughter portrayed him.
That was sort of the first time I had read about his feelings about the book, and that was really shocking and difficult for me.
She realized she needed to reach out. Michelle Zahner shares that moment of reconciliation in the song Lida.
That is a song about the first phone call that brought my father and I back together.
Tell me everything. Everybody's fine. I can tell you're drunk. Wandering somewhere, creation.
I had just called him, and I thought it was kind of sweet to discover that he was sort of tipsy in Crete and answered the phone, tell me everything. Even though your relationship with your family can become quite complicated and painful, many years can pass and you can say something so casual like, tell me everything. And it was actually a really sweet bonding moment between my father and I.
You always take it way too far. Is it the bottle of blood? I can't relate to you at all.
You know, in the end, we're family, and even though we've put each other through a lot, there is sort of always going to be something that ties us to one another.
These days, Michelle Zahner is trying to find balance between all the things she yearns for: her career goals, a connection to family, and a connection to her ancestral home.
I think especially after my mother passed away, I've felt like I've just been running through life trying to do everything I can, because I'm so much more aware of how short it is.
But some things have to pass by. Michelle Zahner spent last year living in Korea. She was tempted to stay, but knew she couldn't.
There was a sadness in having to leave, but also knowing that if I stayed there, I would have to leave behind another life that is quite enjoyable. Then there's a kind of melancholy in sort of looking out at these sort of unlived lives. But it's not a violent longing, it's just kind of a melancholic acceptance.
The new album by Japanese Breakfast is called For Melancholy Brunettes and Sad Women. Lindsay Tati, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A few years ago, the Belgian singer Tamino left his home country to settle in New York.
Leaving behind a place, a relationship, maybe even a belief system.
So he channeled that change and loss into a new album.
Tell me again that you miss me.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Elon Musk is expected at the Pentagon today to meet with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Musk continues to oversee President Trump's efforts to downsize the federal government. Hegseth says he and Musk will be discussing efficiencies and smarter production at the Defense Department. Two progressive members of Congress, a Democrat and an Independent, are calling for the Democratic Party to be more forceful in its pushback against President Trump's agenda. Here's NPR's Stephen Fowler.
At a packed hockey arena on Arizona State University's campus, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders denounced Trump. Sanders painted Trump's Department of Government Efficiency effort to fire federal workers and slash government agencies as morally wrong and illegal.
Every single day, Trump and his friends are ignoring the Constitution of the United States of America.
But the pair also joined the growing chorus of voters who say the Democratic Party needs to do more to defend those institutions and have stronger plans to counter Trump's agenda. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Tempe, Arizona.
Airline passengers in Europe are facing days of flight disruptions because of today's closure of Heathrow Airport in London. A power outage has closed one of the world's busiest airports until tomorrow. This is NPR News. The International Olympic Committee has its first African and first female president. Kirsty Coventry is a two-time Olympic gold medalist in swimming from Zimbabwe. Scientists say new research hints at how the universe could end, and it involves dark energy, as NPR's Chandelise Duster explains.
Scientists with the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument Group say when the universe formed, dark energy, the mysterious force behind its rapid expansion, was very strong. But scientists say dark energy is weakening, and that will continue. Mustafa Ishak, co-chair of the group and astrophysics professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, says this could allow matter to get stronger, which could be the force that causes the universe to ultimately collapse.
We thought before that the universe will keep just expanding and expanding faster and faster and faster and faster. Almost it becomes empty. It is back to the table. The universe now also has the possibility that it will stop and recollapse.
He and other scientists also say there is no current evidence that the universe has stopped expanding. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
Johnson & Johnson says it plans to invest $55 billion in its U.S. operations over the next several years. It'll include four new manufacturing plants. On Wall Street, in early trading, the Dow is down more than 1%. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. An NPR investigation has been reporting on a debacle within the Department of Veteran Affairs that left thousands of vets on the verge of losing their homes. After our first stories aired, the VA halted foreclosures and stood up a rescue program. We can now report that 15,000 veterans have so far been saved from losing their homes and have new affordable mortgages. But there's a movement in Congress that could kill the rescue program. We're joined now by NPR's Quil Lawrence and Chris Arnold for more. So, Chris, the VA home loan is supposed to be a great deal, right? I mean, so how did these 15,000 veterans get in trouble?
These are vets who were on what's called a COVID mortgage forbearance. This was after the pandemic hit and shut down the economy and millions of people lost their jobs. This is a way to take a break from making your mortgage payments, but then have a sanctioned, affordable way to catch up, and Congress set it up and stuff. These vets, though, got stuck when the VA made a really big blunder and turned off a key part of this program when there were still tens of thousands of veterans in the middle of it. We did a story like a year and a half ago when we uncovered this. Back then, there were 40,000 vets that were about to lose their homes, and it wasn't their fault. So the VA stopped the foreclosures for a year while it rolled out this rescue, and now that's finally up and running. And as you were saying, 15,000 veterans so far have gotten these new loans and that they can afford, and they're going to keep their homes.
All right, so that's good news at least. But Quil, you're reporting now that some in Congress want to kill that rescue program.
Right. There are some Republicans who don't like that this program works by having the VA buy these delinquent loans and then put it on the VA's books, that, or essentially put it all the risk on the taxpayers. So there are two new bills in Congress, one that would basically shut down the rescue program and the other would replace it with something else. But the problem is, who knows how long it might take to replace it. And both the housing advocates on one side and the mortgage industry on the other side, they say that right now this rescue program is the only way for these vets to stay in their homes and not get foreclosed on.
Now, Chris, what kind of reaction are you hearing from veterans?
Well, I mean, some are relieved, you know, if they've already gotten into the program and it's been a long time and now they're finally okay. But there are thousands of others who are not approved yet for this new mortgage. Some are scared by these moves in Congress. And look, I mean, basically from their perspective, the VA threw them a lifeline during the pandemic and they grabbed hold of it. But then the VA cut the rope, and now they finally have a way to save their homes with this new loan rescue program. And there's talk of cutting the lifeline again, and that they're just tearing their hair out about this.
Yeah, and one of the dozens of veterans we talked to is Kevin Conlon. He served two tours in Iraq, survived a bunch of bomb blasts there. He lost his best friend there. He struggled with trauma and thoughts of suicide for a while. He nearly lost his house in this VA error, and now he's hearing that the rescue program to keep him in his home could be scrapped.
You're talking about getting rid of something that would keep me and my family in a home that we love, that we need. And to do that to us is just, it's intentionally cruel.
And then you got all this playing out in the middle of this restructuring by the Trump administration. So how's that factoring in, Chris?
Right. I mean, we already know thousands of people have been quickly fired from the VA. They want to fire 80,000 more, apparently. VA won't say, is that in the loan division or where? And they won't comment on this legislation. And all this is stressing out a lot of veterans who are still at risk of losing their houses.
That's NPR's Chris Arnold and Quil Lawrence. Thanks, you two.
Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Humans are still largely untouched by the bird flu outbreak, and maybe that's because of all the flu seasons humans have already lived through. NPR health correspondent Will Stone reports.
Let's start with the last influenza pandemic, the 2009 swine flu outbreak.
Older people, for once, had less severe flu.
That's Alessandro Sette at the La Jolla Institute for Immunology. Turns out older people had dealt with similar flu viruses that were circulating until the late 1950s, and that gave them better protection years later.
They were still getting infected, but they had an advantage.
So could we hope for the same sort of phenomenon, this time with the current strain of bird flu, known as H5N1? What scientists are finding offers some reassurance. Sette's lab, for example, has looked at T cells, a kind of white blood cell. These immune cells hunt down the virus once it's infected a cell. No surprise, Sette found people have T cells that are familiar with seasonal flu.
The question is, if we make the matching fragment from the H5N1 avian flu, would they recognize it just as well? And they do.
Next up are antibodies. These are proteins that bind to parts of a virus. In a study published this month, Sarah Kobe at the University of Chicago and other researchers at the University of Pennsylvania looked for antibodies against seasonal flu virus that cross-react with bird flu.
We found that it tended to be older people who had some level of antibody activity.
These people most certainly never had bird flu, but their antibodies still chipped in.
What's driving that appears to be the viruses that people were infected with in childhood.
It seems those were similar enough to bird flu. Kobe says there's no hard cutoff, but people born roughly before 1965 appear to have this higher level of protection, though she stresses
there's still going to be a lot of individual variation in what this disease could look like if we were to have a pandemic.
Her study focused on antibodies against a key protein on the surface of influenza viruses, the H protein. Seema Lakdawala at Emory University says picture it as a lollipop.
The heads can be very different, but they all have sticks. And so sometimes the sticks look more similar.
That's the case for bird flu and a common type of flu virus in humans, H1N1. The University of Chicago study indicates antibodies against these sticks may help with bird flu. Meanwhile, Lakdawala's lab has run its own experiments. Her team infected ferrets with H1N1, let them fully recover, and later exposed them to bird flu.
These animals all survived. They didn't get that sick, and that the virus, importantly, actually remained restricted to the respiratory tract.
Very different from what scientists had seen before, she says, when animals that had never dealt with influenza were infected with bird flu.
People have described it on calls like the worst virus they've ever put into an animal.
Lakdawala says her team's analysis points to the role of another group of antibodies. These are targeting N1. It's on the surface of the H1N1 flu that's part of our current flu season and also on bird flu. Now, there are lots of caveats here. These results are based on animals, not people. But she says all of this research on pre-existing immunity could be one reason many human cases of bird flu in the U.S. have been mild.
While this is a bit of a silver lining, this does not mean we should all feel like we're safe.
Data from the past two decades show a 50% fatality rate in human cases of bird flu. That's likely an overestimate, but Florian Kramer says a pandemic, even with a much lower fatality rate, would still be devastating. He's a virologist at Mount Sinai.
The pre-existing immunity does very likely not protect us as a population from a new pandemic, but it might give us some protection against severe disease.
And the risk calculus could change as the virus evolves. Will Stone, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Book expert Tracy Thomas on books for Women's History Month, including Ask Not, which spotlights some of the women involved with the Kennedy family, next time here and now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, Mae Martinez. Oscar Wilde wrote that life imitates art. Well, Netflix has taken that to heart. It already has the reality competition series Squid Game The Challenge based on the Korean TV series. Now, Netflix is adding The Golden Ticket based on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Contestants will try to gain entrance into a retro-futuristic chocolate factory. And if they are wise, they'll listen to me. Or the actual host, I guess. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Amanda Aronchik from our Planet Money podcast heard about a hiring controversy last year at one of the country's biggest meat processors. So she went to see if Tyson Foods was taking away jobs from U.S. citizens and giving them to migrant workers.
When Kamakaro first migrated to the U.S., he spent a few months living in the shelter system in New York City. Things were pretty bleak. That is, until he heard about a job with Tyson Foods. My co-reporter Carlos Garcia asked him how he first heard about it.
¿Cómo supo usted del trabajo en Tyson?
A través de un compañero de viaje que venía con nosotros.
His friend told him to go to this office building in Manhattan, and he went. Filled in an application, took a drug test, showed his work permit, and that day he got an offer, $16.50 an hour to cut up chickens. So he moved to a small town in Tennessee and headed to the plant for his first day at work. His first day was cold. He didn't know to bundle up, thought he might die of the cold. Thankfully, Kamakaro did not die. Now, Kamakaro is actually a family name. He asked that we not use his first name because he didn't want to risk losing his job. And he considers this job a blessing. He says, think of all the migrants who arrived in the U.S. He is one of the privileged ones to have gotten a job. Now, right as Kamakaro was getting his job, another Tyson Foods plant, this one in Perry, Iowa, was closing down. This is where the controversy comes in, because Tyson was laying off their workers in Iowa. Jody Wells worked there, and she remembers everyone being called down to the cafeteria.
Well, when we first got there, we're all laughing and joking, and, you know, we're like family there, so.
Then the managers passed around a stack of papers announcing the closing.
And then when they handed that out, you could see people tear up and get mad, and they're asking, what do we do now?
This plant was Perry's biggest employer, and Jody was hearing from people in town about Tyson everywhere.
I know people are upset that they think that immigrants are taking people's jobs.
It's true that while people were being laid off in Iowa, Tyson was hiring migrants in New York. And the accusation was that the laid-off workers were not being given the same opportunities as the migrants. So we asked, did Tyson offer to pay people to move elsewhere, relocate to work at a different plant?
Yes, to Waterloo and Tennessee.
Jody, who worked for the union, said the offer was limited to only some workers. Tyson declined to give us an interview, but a rep emailed to say that anyone who worked at the plant could get a job at a different location. Either way, some of the Iowa workers could have moved to work in Tennessee. Tyson was not giving their jobs to migrants. Tyson Foods is actually one of the largest meatpacking companies in the country. And over the last decade, Tyson opened or expanded 17 facilities, but they also closed 18 large facilities. It's an industry with a high turnover rate. Churning through workers, hiring in one place, laying off somewhere else, is baked into how Tyson does business. That checked out when we followed up with Kamakaro.
Buenas tardes.
¿Cómo le va?
Bien.
Kamakaro says he was laid off by Tyson in January. He didn't know why, and Tyson had no comment. Amanda Aronchik, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. In the coming days, a Morning Edition team will be reporting in China. And that's led by Steve Inskeep. Hey, Steve, why are you going now?
Because of the trade war that the United States has launched against China, Leila. I want to see how this looks from the other side. I want to see how the Chinese respond to American tariffs and really a broader U.S. attitude toward the world. So one of the things we're going to do in China is go to this Chinese business conference, the CDF for Global Business People. That's the China Development Forum. It's a chance to check in on the economy.
And who shows up to a forum like this?
Usually international CEOs, along with specialists in China and its economy, people from Europe, certainly. This year, it seems the Americans are sparse, but there are some. I'm going to be listening for how the government and business leaders present themselves publicly in this global confrontation.
Well, what is China's economy like as the U.S. ramps up tariffs?
The big picture, I think, is pretty well known. China's had slower growth than in the past. Low real estate prices are dragging people down. High tech is pulling them up. But I wanted to get at some of the subtleties. So before traveling, I talked with Don Wang, or Wang Don, as you would call her in China. She has a life story that says a lot about China's evolving economy.
I grew up in Shanxi, in the capital city called Taiyuan. Mm-hmm. It is a coal province, a very conservative city, very conservative province.
Yes.
And my parents both work for the coal bureau.
The coal bureau?
Yeah, old economy. All in this coal mining region that I visited in past years and that reminds me of industrial Appalachia. Mm-hmm. You've got mountains, you've got old factories. Anyway, she got to college in China, and then at the University of Washington in the United States and in Europe. She is super highly educated, and she became an economist, which does not sound as glamorous as you would think.
So I took over a project in a national survey to figure out the feed demand in pork industry. So I studied pigs for 2 years. Right. So between 2013 and 2015, I was the leading expert in the pig industry.
Okay, so were you like studying pig statistics, or did you sometimes go to a farm and, you know, look at pigs?
I spent most of the time, actually, of that 2 years, studying the pig farms and talked to those farmers operating it, what they fed the pig and how did they do disease control. And the ultimate goal is to figure out the soybean demand of China.
Okay, wait. I did not expect this to take a pig turn, but okay, go ahead.
Pigs, and the pigs eat soybeans. A lot of the soybeans have come from the United States, and you can see the relevance here. In fact, China has begun diverting some of its soybean purchases to other countries amid the trade wars that began in the first Trump term. So that is one thing that's happening here. And in her study of pigs, something else became clear.
The most helpful conclusion from that study was that Chinese pig industry has become very efficient. It used to be dominated by backyard producers, but since 2010, there is an important transition that the commercial farms has become a dominant player.
Okay, they're efficient. So efficient that they've produced more pork. That's kept prices down, which sounds good, Layla, except there are many, many Chinese industries that are producing too much stuff. Mm-hmm. And prices are falling, and there's some risk of deflation. We worry about inflation. They're worried about deflation, and pork leads the way.
It is the ultimate factor that would decide inflation.
Wait a minute. Did you just tell me that the pig industry is central to the story of deflation right now, or it's just a factor? How should I think about that?
The pig factor is the most important factor when it comes to inflation in China.
You're blowing my mind. I've not heard this anywhere.
Right. The inflation cycle in China is basically the pork cycle. Pork, of course, it's a very important meat in daily expense for a typical household, but also it's a reflection on the business activities, because most of the pork consumed in China are not by households. Hmm. It's by restaurants, hotels, food processing companies.
And people are not eating out because there's not enough consumer confidence. Hmm. Now, Don Wang, the economist who used to study pigs, knows about the broader effects because she rose to become the chief economist for a major bank in Shanghai, which she did for years, and that gave her a special role in China. In a country where the internet is censored and public debate is limited, she was able to speak out about economic problems.
I don't think the Western listeners or even my Western colleagues holding the same position understand what a privileged job it is to become a chief economist in China, because that's one of the few professions that are allowed to talk publicly, not just about policy changes, but also social changes and occasionally political structure changes. And we could get away with it. And one reason, that's my speculation, is that in the past 40 years, China was focused so much on economic growth. Mm-hmm. But now the priority is on security. The long-term agenda, of course, China will become stronger, people become richer. But in the short term, probably Chinese economy have to suffer a lot of pain. And the chief economists, they are not as outspoken as before. And the public debate space is getting smaller.
I mean, that's surprising to me that there was even space to speak on the economy, but I guess even that's closing now that they're changing their focus.
When I've spoken with her and other economists in the past, they have been very frank about what's going on in the economy. But now that national security is more important, Don Wang has left that job. And in fact, she's moved out of China. She's still analyzing the economy there, but for a private firm, the Eurasia Group, and she's working out of Singapore.
So what is all this saying, everything we heard now about China's economy?
This is a super strong economy that is under a lot of different kinds of stress from the United States and also from within, from the frustrations and disappointments of many of its people. And one of the things that the government is doing to deal with all of this is encouraging Chinese companies to invest more abroad and move production abroad, even move workers abroad. That does a lot of things for them. American firms invest outside the borders of the United States, of course, but one of the reasons seems to be avoiding U.S. tariffs on China and continuing the manufacturing power that brought China to the place where it is now.
Steve, we'll be looking forward to your reports from China. We'll also hear from our colleagues, John Ruich and Anthony Kuhn. Have a good trip.
Thank you so much.
I think the next time we talk, you'll be in China.
You bet.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez.